Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are 2/4 of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in 4 dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Will climate change destroy archaeology?
Could an Egyptian mummy be hiding in a British field?
And how can you check your local area for sites of historical interest?
I'm answering your questions on today's Time Team podcast.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. And yes, today is a question and answers session, which means that if you are a Time Team member, you may well get your question answered. Thank you so much if you got in touch via Patreon. If you are a Time Team member, you support us there on Patreon. You just go to the chats section and you can contribute to the conversation that is ongoing with lots of people asking questions. And I pick some of them and I put them in front of Helen and I say, go on, Helen. What do you think the answer to this is? We will also get to Helen's find as well. And any little clues, Helen, as to what your find is about this week?
It is related to one of the questions, yes.
Interesting. Right, fine. Well, that is coming up in a bit. Let's dive straight in, though, shall we? With a question here, number one comes from Pierre. And Pierre says, I have a very basic question. Now, look, basic questions are very much welcomed on this podcast because sometimes they can be more thought-provoking than the really complicated ones. I have a very basic question. Seems to be a huge focus on nearly every dig. What exactly are the ditches that you're exploring? This is a really good question because you hear a lot of the time, yeah, we've been doing this in this ditch. What are these ditches? Do you focus on ditches because they become repositories for accidental artifacts? Did ancient civilizations build ditches specifically to dump refuse, or did they happen more organically, creating them as needed? Was refuse dumped and immediately covered in soil, or was it allowed to degrade over time? So lots of possible options there from Pierre, but let's just start with the basics, Helen. In an archaeological context, what is a ditch?
Yes, what is a ditch? It's a kind of generic term for what archaeologists also have a rather horrible jargon term for. They sometimes call it a linear, and that's a shortening of linear feature. So I prefer ditch because linear feature is an attempt to remove any kind of interpretation. But if you ask me, a ditch doesn't have any interpretation with it. It's just a hole in the ground that has to go somewhere. So it can't just be a hole where rubbish was dumped. A round hole that doesn't go anywhere is a pit. I think the reason that we talk about ditches so much is that they survive really well. Because they're deliberately dug into the earth, you can see them on earthworks, can preserve them. So if an area hasn't been ploughed, you'll still be able to see where that ditch was dug. They turn up as crop marks. They turn up on geophysics. One of the reasons they turn up on geophysics, which I've only just discovered last summer at Sutton Hoo while excavating tree throws that came up on geophysics, is that once you disturb the earth and you introduce bacteria and a different kind of decay process, the bacteria can use the oxygen and the organics in the soil to create a kind of deposit that's more visible to magnetometry. It's a more magnetic kind of sediment. And that's why you don't have to always have rubbish dumped in a ditch to be able to see it on geophysics. So essentially, a ditch is a hole that goes in one direction or another. If you dig a hole and it stays where it is, that is a pit. So those are the two big differences.
And why are archaeologists so interested in them?
Well, it is to a certain extent that a ditch can be a magnet for finds, but not always. The reason that archaeologists are interested in them is that they can see them. It's as basic as that. If you build a wall of stone, for example, somebody can come along and remove your wall and reuse the stone elsewhere. The wall is also in the way, so it tends to get levelled. A ditch just silts up and is well preserved. So we use the ditches because they're what we've got. We have to use what we've got, and ditches are one of the most obvious things of what we've got. But the thing about ditches is you've got to have a reason. Once you've dug your hole, you've got to have a reason to go somewhere with it. And there are two main reasons for going somewhere with a ditch. The first one is drainage. If you cast your mind back to the Cherrington Revisited programme and the appalling torrential rain.
Yes, it was an absolute downpour.
Yes. The rain wasn't going anywhere until Richard dug a little ditch. I mean, OK, something as small as that is often called a gully, another awful bit of jargon, because it doesn't seem to be big enough to be a ditch. But once it's encountered the subsoil, once it's large, once you can fall into it, that's a ditch. And often they're built to carry away rainwater. It's actually possible that some ridge and furrow might have been created in order to improve drainage. So if you've got ridge and furrow that goes down a hill and it's a damp clayey soil, maybe that was put there to improve the drainage rather than merely to as an accident of ploughing or to create a larger surface area, which is another thing that's been suggested for ridge and furrow. So this drainage idea is the reason why nearly every hedge in East Anglia is accompanied by a ditch. They're very familiar to me where I live now, but that isn't the case where I grew up in North Somerset. Ditches are actually quite rare there because it's all steep limestone slopes, and so it pretty much drains itself. You don't really need ditches there. But you do get ditches there, because that brings me on to the second function, which is they're very useful as boundaries. We really love a boundary ditch on an excavation, partly because if, say, you're digging something like a cemetery, a ditch, a boundary ditch, can give you an edge. And we just love edges. As you know, all archaeologists love an edge.
And could it be as well that if you are building up a mound, you would obviously dig the ditch, take the soil from the ditch and put it on your mound, but then over the years the mound gets flattened but the ditch remains?
Yes, that's a particular kind of ditch known as a quarry ditch. So you can have a drainage ditch, a boundary ditch, a quarry ditch, where the aim isn't to dig a ditch, it's to get the stuff out. It's literally a quarry. So that's, again, another form of ditch. A boundary ditch around a field, which is often accompanied by a hedge, if you trace those through aerial photographs or geophysics or whatever, that can give you the grain of the landscape. So you can see a field system. And a field system that's entirely bounded by hedges might be completely invisible. Hedges are a really tantalising thing. It has a huge presence in the landscape while it's there. Once you remove it, it doesn't have quite so much to show where it was. It might have a bit of environmental evidence. You might get the odd snail living in there that likes a hedge, that doesn't like the open field, but you're very lucky if you can find the remains of a hedge. If you've got a ditch, though, you can often infer the presence of a hedge. But the question asked about rubbish. Now, with a quarry ditch, you could then reuse it for rubbish. But with a boundary ditch or a drainage ditch, you definitely don't want to fill it up with rubbish. And one of the things that farmers have always done in the winter, whether that's hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, or today, in the winter, when you don't have so much to do, you clear your ditches, you dig them out, you do hedging and ditching. So they're not always the brilliant kind of finds traps that you might think. In theory, they could be. But because they get scoured out every year, every couple of years, they don't always have what you might expect in them. Now, I did want to just tackle this idea of rubbish disposal as well, because Pierre's also asked about how refuse is dumped. Do you dig a hole specifically to dump refuse? What do you do? And rubbish, of course, you know, is such a big part of archaeology. So we need to talk about it. And you might want to dig a pit to dispose of your rubbish, but you don't have to, because ancient rubbish, of course, there's not nearly as much rubbish in the past as there is now. And almost all ancient rubbish is also potentially manure. There are always going to be things like broken glass and broken metal items that you can melt down and reuse. There's also going to be pottery, which is really hard to recycle. But everything else is going to rot down into manure. Even wood and bone eventually, even antler will rot down into manure eventually. And you can use this manure, of course, to put on your fields to increase fertility. Now, it seems weirdly that before the late Anglo-Saxon period, people weren't doing this, that you don't find evidence in the form of tiny sherds of abraded pottery. You don't find evidence of manuring on fields. I don't know whether that's because manuring really wasn't done or because the pottery is not sturdy enough or there just wasn't enough of it. The one sherd here and the one sherd there that you might find in manuring, there's just not the weight of evidence to be able to see it. So what did they do with their rubbish? Rubbish pits are not always the norm. When they are created, so there's a lot of rubbish pits in the Iron Age. There is also this thing called the sunken featured building in the Anglo-Saxon period that seems to be then reused as a rubbish pit. It's not just casual throwing away of the rubbish. It's not what you might call just utilitarian, because there's patterns in how those pits, those hollows have been filled. They're known as structured deposits. There are people who work on these, both in the Iron Age and in the Anglo-Saxon period, and it is phenomenally complicated. So if people are interested in rubbish disposal in the past, which is, I think, an interesting thing to talk about, I wonder if we ought to get somebody who specialises in this to come and talk about it, because it's a whole other world. There's whole books written on manuring. There's whole books written on structured deposits. It's an entire research community in itself and a fascinating one.
Yeah. So what you're saying is we need somebody to come on this podcast to talk a load of rubbish that isn't me.
That is true. Yes, we need to talk rubbish a bit more, I think.
Okay.
Yes. In a highly scholarly way.
Yes, a highly scholarly rubbish needs to be talked about. Well, thank you very much, Pierre, for that question. Let's move on to question number two, just before we get to Helen's fine, which is on the way in just a moment. Michael's got in touch with this one, and Michael says, you've mentioned climate change a few times and the effect of weather and climate on the environment at surface level around us is clear to see. But as I sit here typing, the temperature is over 32 degrees Celsius. Now, Michael, I can therefore pinpoint pretty much the exact day that you must have written this, because a few weeks ago we had quite the heat wave and everybody was sweltering in ridiculous heat. It was so, so warm. What does extreme heat, or cold for that matter, do to archaeology below the ground? Does the contracting or expansion of subsurface earth cause problems to the integrity of buried artefacts?
Yeah, now that's an interesting question. I don't think that the subsurface earth is going to change in heat that much. It's not going to contract or expand too much because it's fairly moist. I don't think that the buried artefacts are going to suffer a great deal. The thing that does suffer is the buried deposits, so soil layers and stratigraphy. That's mainly a problem in archaeology in the deep prehistory of the Paleolithic, because of the ice ages. Now, as I understand it, apparently we are technically currently in an interglacial episode within an ice age. And the start of our interglacial that we're living in at the moment, the start of that relative warmth came in with the Mesolithic, or rather the Mesolithic came in with that warmth. So at the point where it began to, again, to be livable in Britain, that's what we call the Mesolithic. And before the Mesolithic, the area of Britain roughly marked the kind of southern limit of glaciers, which came south and retreated north over tens or hundreds of thousands of years. Now, it may feel a bit odd that we are technically living in an interglacial, and I'm not completely sure that we are anymore, because I think that we may have halted this natural cycle with man-made carbon emissions. So I don't really want anybody to be ringing me up from the future in 1,000 years saying, actually, you were wrong. We're not in an interglacial. The glaciers never came back. The ice age is over. Yes, but not naturally. It would be unnaturally over, if you see what I mean. So anyway, back to glaciation. The problem with it is that the glaciers move a great deal of soil and bedrock around because they're incredibly heavy and they're immensely powerful. And so they kind of scour the ground so that intact archaeological sites from the Paleolithic are incredibly rare. So places like Boxgrove in Sussex, which became famous a few years ago for producing human remains of early Paleolithic date, which for some reason is not called the early Paleolithic, it's called the lower Paleolithic. I think that's something to do with geology. You have to be just as much a geologist to understand the Paleolithic as you have to be an archaeologist. So Boxgrove, I think that was a surface that was at the foot of a chalk cliff, and the glacier came across the cliff and scoured it down and buried it. But that little bit of surface at the foot of the cliff was protected by it. So something like Boxgrove is incredibly rare, these amazing preservation conditions. So first, it's amazing that it's been preserved. Secondly, it's amazing that we've found it. So they always have to be excavated with the absolute utmost delicacy and care, because we have to retrieve absolutely every scrap of evidence. So at Boxgrove, we are talking about 500,000 years old. So that's definitely pre-Homo sapiens.
Wow.
Then closer to my home now, at Haysborough in Norfolk, there was another really famous find about 20 years ago. It was a Paleolithic river valley that got really deeply buried in sediment. It was buried deeply enough by the time the most recent glaciers came that it was never scoured or eroded away completely. And now we've found it because it's coming out of the collapsing cliff face on the Norfolk coast. And not only flint tools, but also amazingly footprints have been found in that really deeply buried river sediment. But the flint tools are so fresh looking, they look almost like they could have been made yesterday. But they're even older than Boxgrove. They're at least 750,000 years old. They could be even older.
Amazing. Amazing.
Yes. So this has got me into talking about the Paleolithic and ice ages. And they show you what the power of the climate can do, really. The extreme heat is something that we have never really had to deal with since humans have evolved. So we're in uncharted territory there, that we're in the land of the giant dragonflies and the dinosaurs in terms of heat.
Yeah, well, we are, aren't we? And so anything could happen to the archaeology, but then also nothing could happen, I suppose, is the summary of the answer there. Michael, thank you very, very much indeed for the question. Shall we move on to Helen's find? I'm very excited about doing this. More questions to come in just a moment. But first, this is Helen's find, where she picks an object that you maybe have never come across before, sets it in a bit of archaeological context. So what have you gone for this time?
Well, Martin, would you like to have a look at the Haysborough hand axe?
Yes, I would. And I am just opening up the link. And this link, by the way, is in the description of this podcast, so you can see this object on the Portable Antiquities Scheme as well. Ah, this is a piece of flint.
It is. It is an extremely beautiful object. And you can see the first image is a drawing, a technical drawing that shows you all of the ways in which it was made. It was chipped, flaked, napped, you might call it, to make it. But below is the photograph, which is just the most lovely thing. Black, shiny, faceted, glittering. It always reminds me of, I once spent a long car journey with Phil Harding, who was waxing lyrical about an object called a twisted chordate axe. And he said it was like a raindrop in motion turned to stone. And he honestly spent about 3/4 of an hour telling me how beautiful this thing was. And I think you could say the same about the Haysborough hand axe. It is absolutely astonishingly beautiful, just as a piece of art. Now, the dating of it is a bit contentious because it's so difficult to date. It's based on the sediments above and below it. And those sediments are too old to be able to radiocarbon date, because radiocarbon dating is based on the radioactive decay of the carbon-14 isotope. And it has completely decayed by the time we get to 50,000 years ago. So anything older than that can't be done by radiocarbon dating. As I understand it, the sediments above and below have been dated by looking at the vole teeth, which are contained within them. Vole teeth, voles apparently evolve quite rapidly, and their teeth change shape, and they're the best dating that you can get. Now, you can imagine the amount of sediment that had to be gone through to find the vole teeth to date. It is not a quick job. And it's also, it is slightly contentious. There are other ways of dating. So if you do research around this, there's a lot on the internet written by geologists and geomorphologists and geophysicists and paleontologists and paleomagnetism experts. Nobody quite agrees, but it's somewhere between 750,000 and 1,000,000 years old.
Wow.
Now, you probably think, looking at it, well, it almost looks like it could have been made yesterday. And I think, exceptionally, I'm going to have to direct you to another. We're going to look at two finds.
Oh, yes. Okay, so there is another link. You'll be able to see it in the description. If you click on that, you'll see even more flint.
Yes, now this one has come from a gravel quarry in Devon.
And this one's a bit yellowy.
Oh, it's very yellow. It's very yellow, and it looks like it's got rounded edges, and it looks like it's been through a stone tumbler almost. So Devon is a long way south. You may think that the glaciers haven't got that far. I am not entirely sure, but a lot of the vast bulk of these hand axes that we have recorded on the Portable Antiquity Scheme database come from southern England, and they are almost all either white or yellowy orange. And the white ones have been in a chalky environment, and the orange yellow ones have been in an iron rich environment. They have not been sitting in that kind of stable sediment like the Haysborough hand axe for hundreds of thousands of years. They've been constantly rolled around, and they've been subject to these huge physical forces and also chemical forces, which have actually changed the colour of the stone. Now, I don't know as much about these as I should. I completely need somebody like Phil Harding to tell me exactly how they were made, how they were used, and so on. But the thing that I find incredible is that they were made by a different species of human to us. We just can't imagine what it must have been like to live with several species of hominid, of human. And these objects are really the only things we have that allow us a little step into their world. Doesn't it amaze you too, Martin, the idea that you could hold in your hand something that had been made by an extinct species of human?
That is incredible. And I do often find myself thinking about Neanderthals, which is, I don't know, something I should necessarily do, but I do because I do think, wouldn't that be amazing? You know, we as you say, Helen, we are so used to being the dominant species of human, well, the only species of human, but the dominant kind of intelligent life forms on this planet. We could have been born into a situation where we were sharing the world with other species of human who could talk and have culture and life. And
yet be different to us in a way that we can't really understand. That we're so used to ourselves as being exceptional. You have the humans and the animals, but we are just animals underneath. And how wonderful it would be to be able to have a conversation with somebody who was like us, but not like us, and not just in a cultural way, in an actual biological way. All of that richness of potential hominid culture that we've lost, presumably from being too violent and unpleasant as large groups of Homo sapiens.
Yeah, or too amorous as well.
Yes, we either fight or we outbreed.
Yes. One of those two things. Well, that has really got my imagination going, and it's all through those objects, which is the whole point of this, really. You can go and see them for yourself, as I mentioned right now, because I've put links to both of those pieces of flint on the Portable Antiquity Scheme. I've put them in the description of the podcast that you're listening to right now.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the Hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. Martin, can we talk about Egyptian mummies now, please? I gather there's a question about that.
I thought you'd never ask. Yes, there is a question that's come in. This is from Shona Twining, who says, I've read that Egyptian mummies were at one point ground up and exported to the UK for use as fertilizer and possibly other industrial uses. Assuming that's true, has anything like amulets, beads, scarabs, or other burial objects ever survived the process and later been found in old agricultural fields? I love this question. Or, suggests Shona, were the remains generally processed so thoroughly that nothing recognisable would make it through? And Shona says that she's fascinated by the idea that fragments of ancient Egypt could theoretically still be sitting in British farmland somewhere. I'm now fascinated by that idea, having only just learned about it. Could this be true? Could this be something that happened then, Helen?
Well, I don't know. I've also heard this too, this kind of rumour that mummies were used for fertiliser, but I don't know if it's based on any kind of fact. The only things that I've been able to find out is that undoubtedly mummies were sold in Egypt in the 19th century, and they were bought and they came to Britain. Because there were things like mummy unwrapping parties, would you believe? They were like all those scientific entertainments of the late 18th and 19th centuries, like taking laughing gas and so on. Come round and we'll do something fun and we'll learn something scientific. They all sound like great fun to me.
Well, they do, except for the fart that you're sort of ruining thousands of years of archaeology by just sort of having a little party where you open up a mummy. Yeah,
but
it does sound like fun.
You have to do the wrong thing in order to do the right thing sometimes. And before X-rays, nobody knew that there were going to be X-rays. Nobody knew that there were going to be MRI scans and all that imaging and so on and so forth. I think you have to make some mistakes. You can't make an omelette without breaking eggs. I don't want to judge.
Yeah. We should say as well that they weren't our mummies to take in the first place, were they, either?
This
needs to be probably mentioned. But taken they were and all of this happened. And presumably people did learn things through this process.
Yes, they must have done. But moving on to the other part of circumstantial evidence, I did have a quick hunt through the history of fertiliser for this as well. Before fertilisers were available that were based on ammonia and petrochemicals, the kind of industrial factory-made fertilisers, farmers used whatever they could get their hands on. So we tend to think of manuring as being animal droppings, so you could pen your animals onto your arable fields, or you could move the dung, shovel it out and do your muck spreading, shoveling it out from barns and sheds and so on. Or it could be like the kind of compost-based domestic rubbish. But the thing is that you just can't get very much of that. And as the agricultural revolution continued through the 19th century, more and more fertilizer was wanted. So they started using guano, and that is bird droppings that's quarried, almost mined from islands normally, because it's seabirds that produce the most. So it's islands off South America, Peru mainly, and South Africa, mainly Namibia. And that produced, well, Peru exported apparently 700,000 tons of guano in 1870 in just 1 year. So how could mummies ever have competed with this? I would reckon that mummies were always more precious than just to be ground up for fertiliser. They were always more scientifically interesting. You'd have got more parties and more fun out of a mummy than you would have ever got fertiliser. So I don't know about the fertiliser theory, but clearly there was an awful lot of collecting by wealthy Westerners and particularly British people. You know, I never thought when I started this podcast that I would be discussing the tonnage of mummies that might have been ground up for fertilizer. But you
yeah,
know,
but here we are.
Your questions do let us go down some very strange routes. But anyway, getting back to the idea that there are the collectors who go on the grand tour, they might get to Egypt, they'll certainly go through Italy and Greece, and they'll pick things up and they'll put them in their collections, and then they might lose them. And I think that's the evidence that we're seeing. So I had a look on the Portable Antiquities Scheme for anything from ancient Egypt, and we've just got a few. We've got a possible Bronze Age bead. We've got a pottery vessel that may have come from Egypt or may have come from Cyprus that was found in a Victorian bottle dump. So that's clearly been found or bought and kept and then dumped in the Victorian period. A flint arrowhead of Egyptian type was found on the drive up to Walterton Hall in Norfolk. So that seems to have been a collector who perhaps got a flint arrowhead and thought, wouldn't it be fun to try it out? Got it, put on an arrow maybe, shot it. It fell on by the drive and was only found relatively recently. There's also quite a lot of small statuettes, the kind of thing that you might buy in a souvenir market, bring home and lose. Now, this is a question that we've also been trying to answer for ancient Greek coinage in Britain. There's a slow but steady amount of ancient Greek coinage that's found by metal detectorists, and we have in the past said, oh, probably from 19th century collections. But the more that arrives, I think we ought to be looking at this again and saying, well, could these ancient Greek coins have come in exchange for possibly something like Cornish tin in the past, well into the past, not just the Victorian era? I think there's arguments for that at the moment with the ancient Greek coins. For the ancient Egyptian stuff, it's all collectors. It's all looking like aristocratic collectors. None of it is looking like a kind of industrial fertilizer thing. But I do really like that question. And I think the more we can talk about rubbish, like in our first question this week, the more we can talk about rubbish, the more we can talk about manuring, the more we'll understand about what people were really doing in the past.
The fertilizer, the more I think about the fertilizer idea, the more mad it seems. I just think it just can't be true. It can't be that farmers were grinding up ancient Egyptian mummies and muck spreading it across a field. It just, I'm sure that mummies are tiny and fields are massive and there's loads of them.
And also, this is the era of the startup of the big beef herds and things like that. If you wanted to grind bones up to put them on your fields, wouldn't you just go to the corned beef canning factory and ask for them?
I think you would. Yeah, I think you would. Anyway, it's an interesting thought, isn't it? And thank you, Shona, for the question, because I think it's one of the, it's up there. It's certainly up. It's certainly in the top top 10, maybe even top 5 of questions that we've had on this podcast. Good fun. Final question then. Let's see how Paul gets on. Paul says, hi, I live in Bolton. And when driving to Blackburn, we pass what I've always told the kids are Viking burial mounds. I'm sure they won't be, but how can you check the area? Where do I start? This is a really good question, not just for this specific thing near Blackburn, but in general, you know, there'll be people who very often will drive past something or they'll go on a walk and they'll see something and they'll go, oh, I wonder if that could be a dot, dot, dot. But they'll think, I have no idea how to kind of look that up, how to discover that for myself. What advice, Helen, do you have for people who are wanting to know more about their local area?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. I think if you've spotted something that's in the landscape, but you don't know what it is, and there's no interpretation board or anything like that, probably the best thing to do to start is going to be to look at a map just to fix where you are so that you can ask further questions. And if you look at the Ordnance Survey First Edition map, you may find that the Ordnance Survey, which used to go out asking, as part of its survey, it would ask about archaeological sites. So often it says something like site of Roman villa or tumulus or something like that. Now, you don't have to leave the house to get access to the Ordnance Survey first editions. They're on the National Library of Scotland's website. I don't know why it's Scotland when it covers the whole of the UK, but the National Library of Scotland have produced this amazing resource. That would let you look at what your landscape, the landscape that you're interested in, looked like in the 19th century. And it will also allow you to get a fix on exactly where your mysterious site is. Then the next thing to do, well, this is the quickest way to find out something about a site, but not necessarily the easiest. It takes quite a bit of Googling, is to find your local historic environment record, or HER for short. And to do this, you have to know what local authority area you're in. Now, I think Bolton is in Greater Manchester. Blackburn seems to be its own unitary authority, and each authority is going to have its own historic environment record. But it might share it with another area. So it's possible that Blackburn may still come under Lancashire. So you can either look for, you can either Google it, or you can go in through a site called Heritage Gateway, which gives you access to all the historic environment records which are online. Now, I went on the Greater Manchester Historic Environment Record this morning, and I searched for Bolton Burial Mound. And I found four records, and they all looked absolutely fascinating. They had these amazing names like Hasty Knoll, Adams Hill, The Two Lads. I don't know what any of these are, but I think it'd be worth a look, Paul, to see if they're what you're driving past, and see what the history is there. So they'll give you everything that's known about those. Now, Blackburn seems to be much more difficult to research. I couldn't get much out of the Lancashire HER online, but I did notice that Blackburn has a sensational museum. It was built in the 19th century, right at the peak of Blackburn's prosperity, and it just looks amazing. And they should be able to point you in the right direction as well. They have amazing numismatic collections and social history collections, and they'll also have connections to local history groups, archaeology groups, and so on and so forth. You can start your research there. Now, that's just two little pointers, the Ordnance Survey historic maps and the historic environment records. But there are so many ways to answer this question. And possibly the best solution all round would be to get hold of a copy of the Time Team book by Tim Taylor called Dig Village. That's all about how to research your local area. You can read that and take those tools for researching your local area to researching something that perhaps isn't your local area that you might just drive past. It's always harder if it's not somewhere you know really, really well. And I have to admit that the northwest of England is possibly the area of the country, of the whole of the UK, that I know the least about. It's Stuart, you know, Stuart does that.
Yeah, that's Stuart's area. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I would probably phone a friend, but the alternative might be to Google the HERs, to get a copy of Dig Village, and just start and see where it takes you.
Really, really good question to end on, Paul, I think, because I think loads of people have this exact thing where they want to know more about something that is local to them, but they just don't know how to go about looking it up. So some really, really good advice, hopefully, that's helped you. Let us know, actually. Let us know how you get on and what you're able to find out. Thank you very much for all the questions that you sent in. It's been really, really good to get them. You can add yours to the ever-growing list now. Head to Patreon if you're a Time Team member and just click on the chats section. You can follow the links there and you can ask your question for a future episode.
We're back on Time Team's YouTube channel next week, so you'll be able to see us as well as hear us. I don't know whether you feel that's a bonus or not, but don't forget that...
Depends who you're talking about, I think, yeah.
Now, don't forget that every episode of the podcast that we make is available ad-free for Time Team members on Patreon, and there you can also find bonus episodes too. So for more information, visit patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
And we'll see you next week on the Time Team podcast. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the Hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So, for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.